Perimeter Institute on behalf of the organizers, and I will not attempt to list them. This is the, as far as I know, the largest ever organizing committee of a cosmology conference, at least that I'm aware of. But thank you all for coming. And the conference, I should say, is about challenges for early universe cosmology. And we hope there will be a very frank and self-critical discussion of all the challenges faced by all of our different scenarios. And we've deliberately designed the conference to allow a lot of interaction time. So I think between 1 and 4 every day, it's just time for you to hang out, enjoy this amazing facility, and of course we hope you will all come back as often as you can. Perimeter is an incredible resource for the world of theoretical physics, and that is how we try to run it, as a real resource for the whole community. And so let me also encourage you, if you have ideas or thoughts as to what we should be doing here, please don't hesitate to make suggestions. Please. A resort and a resource. Yep. And there are even some attractions outside of Perimeter. Okay, now, the conference is about challenges, but unfortunately the first challenge was getting the bus this morning, and I gather some people missed it. So unfortunately there will be people drifting in during my talk. But the challenges we're going to talk about will be much more intellectual ones, I hope. So I was put in the hot seat to give this talk by the other organizers, rather reluctantly. And I hope I will serve as a lightning rod. I'm happy to do that. And so if you feel the need to get rid of some excess energy or antagonism, you know, I'm your guy. So I've deliberately tried to make the talk somewhat provocative, but I will mention questions which I don't know the answer to, and maybe there are people here who do. And I'm going to take the point of view that the challenges we face in early universe cosmology are very, very large and many. We have a concordance model, which is remarkably successful phenomenologically, but the minute you start to dig deeper into the foundations of this model, you discover many weaknesses. I'll talk a little bit about anthropics, because the discussion has been pervasive, and I have to declare myself less than compelled by the arguments, and I'll explain why. But most of the talk will be about measures. And the point of view I will take, as I said, will be very provocative. I will claim there is a measure. We're given a measure from the structure of the theory. And there is a fairly simple way to use it. Unfortunately, this measure doesn't give the answer we would like. According to this measure, inflation is not a generic phenomenon. It's an exceptional phenomenon. And without a theory of initial conditions, inflation cannot be considered, in my view, cannot be considered a solution of the big problems in cosmology. So let me just remind you, the concordance model pictured here, inflation is now regarded by the community as the observationally tested and proven. But the whole point of my talk will be to challenge how far we understand the foundations of inflation, and whether we must have a theory of initial conditions for this scenario to work. I was fortunate to be involved in some of the phenomenology in the early 90s. This was really, in a way, the golden age of modern cosmology, where you could do a calculation based on reliable physical principles and make predictions like this one, the correlation of the polarization with the temperature of the CMB. And so these were spectacular successes that, based on very simple arguments and known physics, general relativity and plasma physics, we could calculate what was about to be observed. And actually, just to remark, at the time we did these calculations, the experimentalists told us this will never be tested. It's much too difficult to test this. And yet, 10 years later, the measurement was routine. So that was really an amazing experience as a theorist, to be able to calculate something which even the experimentalists didn't know they could measure. And then later on, they did. And of course, this became more and more accurate. And the beauty of this polarization measurement is that you can fit all the parameters to the temperature measurement, and then this is essentially a parameter-free prediction of the theory. And it works beautifully. So what is this telling us? Well, I would say we have great evidence for the following. We know we're in a nearly flat FRW universe. At least we have lots of evidence for this. We have a collection of different forms of energy, lambda, CDM, baryons, massive neutrinos, photons in these proportions. And we also know from the observations, or at least we have very strong evidence, that the primordial perturbations were linear, small amplitude, were growing mode. The decaying mode seems not to be there, which isn't surprising if they were produced in comparable amplitudes. Nearly scale invariant perturbations, nearly adiabatic. That just means that locally the composition of the universe did not change from place to place, and nearly Gaussian. Well, these are pretty simple. This is a very simple description. In fact, this description is considerably simpler than any of the theories we use to explain it. But what I want to emphasize is it seems that the universe is geometrically very, very simple. Okay, it's geometrically flat, homogeneous on large scales. The perturbations can be thought of as curvature, scale invariant curvature perturbations. In a sense, it couldn't possibly be any simpler as far as the geometry goes. Okay. It could have zero perturbations, okay? But apart from that case, it's flat and has scale invariant perturbations. That, to me, is a very striking clue that the origin of the universe and of the perturbations has to somehow incorporate a very simple geometry. Compositionally, it's really very complicated. We have dark energy, dark matter, neutrinos, photons. All of these things scale differently with the expansion of the universe. Lambda's constant, baryons go, the density goes as 1 over 8 cubed, neutrinos goes as 1 over 8 to the fourth, then 1 over 8 cubed when the mass becomes important. And photons going as 1 over 8 to the fourth. And yet, for some very strange reason, all of their magnitudes are comparable today. So there's this huge coincidence problem, which at the very least, I think, implies, my interpretation would be, there's got to be some kind of post-selection going on. This was not somebody throwing a dart at various values and just running it forward and see what happened. Okay, one possibility is an anthropic style argument to try and explain all these things, and many people do that. But the other possibility is that that there's a longer history of the universe, and perhaps there was a phase of the universe like today, but before the Big Bang, and so that these parameters actually played a role in preparing the universe for the Big Bang, or in fact governing its cyclical evolution. These are just two ideas, but the basic fact is that there's a huge puzzle about the conspiracy between the different forms of energy in the universe, the apparent conspiracy. Now, here's my cartoon of inflation, and it's deliberately intended to be provocative. But inflation, as you know, is a ingeniously simple mechanism for producing a big universe like the one we see. But it involves various degrees of tuning, one of which, pictured here, is the initial conditions. For some reason, this scalar field was displaced from its minimum in a region of space as big of several Hubble volumes, at least. For some reason, the scalar field was displaced. Secondly, we have to adjust the shape of this potential. Generic potential just won't give enough inflation or produce the right amplitude of density perturbations, so there's a lot of tuning. And finally, there's this really horrendous tuning that we have to tune the vacuum energy of the final minimum to be 10 to the minus 120 in Planck units. And that's terrible, especially in the context of inflation, because inflation is driven, in a sense, by a vacuum energy, but it's got to be many, many orders of magnitude larger. And so this inevitably means that whenever I write down an inflationary model, it will have this crazy degree of fine-tuning in it. And so again, the solution is either some kind of anthropic argument, or you have the idea that somehow the vacuum energy actually played a role in the evolution of the universe before the Big Bang. And there was time before the Big Bang for the vacuum energy to relax. And that's the cyclical picture. Now, these three sort of obvious problems are superseded, I think, by the problem of eternal inflation. And eternal inflation is believed to be very generic. Certainly if you have a false vacuum in your theory and the tunneling rate is low, the inflation will go on forever. That's just classical eternal inflation. And also, people argue that the quantum fluctuations in a gently sloping potential will kick you up the hill and produce eternal inflation as well. And here I'd just like to quote one of my co-organizers, Alan Guth, who said, anything that can happen, and it will happen an infinite number of times. And right away you see that this theory has a big problem, which is the measure problem. How, when I have everything possible occurring somewhere infinitely many times, how do I compare probabilities? How do I calculate probabilities? The idea of the landscape from string theory exacerbated this problem because it enormously enlarged the space of possible inflationary cosmologies, not just one scalar field, many scalar fields in a very complicated potential. And I think the combination of these features, well, certainly this landscape feature, pushed people towards a reliance on anthropic arguments. So let me just begin by saying something about these and why I feel they're very unsatisfactory. So the hypothesis is that the universe is the way it is because of a gigantic selection effect. The laws of physics allow all kinds of universes, nothing like ours, but we are here in a particular universe, and our existence is a huge selection effect. The way I like to describe it is that Hubble's constant was measured by Hubble. I mean, Hubble measured the expansion rate of the universe, and so there was a correlation between Edwin Hubble and the expansion rate of the universe, and so the quantity, the expansion rate measured by Hubble, is Hubble's constant. Now, this is fine. This is just physics. This is just doing correlations. I mean, if you correlate an observer thought of as a physical system with the system being observed, and you're really able to calculate the correlation, then I think that's just normal physics. But the trouble is that these theories we're considering seem to give as the generic cosmology something that is wildly different than what we see. And so the basic question for anthropic cosmologists is, why are we not close to extinction? I mean, if the reason, so, you know, you can think about the following. Imagine you send out a bunch of astronauts to a large number of planets. And you don't tell them in advance. You just randomly send millions of astronauts to a collection of planets. And some of them have no atmosphere. And so the poor astronaut will open the spaceship and die immediately. Some of them have a very thin atmosphere. Some have a slightly toxic atmosphere. You know, what's going to happen? Well, I think most of the people who survive, you know, will undergo a pretty rapid death, an unpleasant death. And for me, this is the one thing anthropics, you know, really doesn't explain. I mean, the universe seems very stable. It's not about to collapse. That it's stable in the long term? We don't seem to be. Well, you get into the question of what do you mean by extinction. I mean, we are close to extinction as our generation of people. There will be a new generation that kind of use computers much more easily than we do, and they will be born. So, yeah, we are close to extinction in that sense, as the type of people we are. And in the cosmic sense. So you would say, yeah, but you see, lambda doesn't seem anywhere near big enough to threaten my existence. That's all I'm saying. The curvature of space, I mean, it's more dramatic if you say, so this basic fact, the universe is geometrically incredibly simple, flat, scale invariant perturbations. Is that what you'd expect if anthropic selection was important? No. I mean, I would expect that the universe in the vicinity of the person, you know, being selected for. Well, okay. So this is a question. I would love to see the explanation for why we're not living in an isolated galaxy with nothing around us. So some calculations certainly do predict that. Some calculations predict a completely empty universe with one galaxy and we live in there. And, you know, this is a big question as to whether the kinds of, this comes down to measures.
This is clearly an important challenge.
Exactly. Why are the fluctuations scale invariant on scales much larger than galaxy scales? We measure the cosmic microwave background and we see the scale invariance apparently persisting. There are many things that could have destroyed it. The curvature of space. I'll show you some models later where kinetic domination of the inflaton cut off the scale invariance. It's very surprising that the scale invariance seems to just persist in a regime where it's not required for our presence. And so, obviously, and this is stating the obvious, for anthropic arguments to become convincing, we must have well-defined measures and projections. measures, because we've got to understand what the theory gives as a typical universe, the probability of each kind of universe. We also must understand what it means to select a universe in which we are there. And I think neither of these things are well developed, but I'm going to, at least in my opinion, but I'm going to focus on the measures, the projection I have no idea how to implement. So, the measure problem. What is the natural measure on the space of cosmological solutions? What's the likelihood of a universe like ours in a given physical model? By which I mean a given set of laws of physics. For example, an inflationary model or a cyclic model. So, what I'm going to tell you is, in a sense, a straw man. I'm going to put before you a measure which I will claim is very well defined, satisfies all the principles we would require of a measure, gives you a way to count the states in the system in a manner that doesn't violate the basic structure of the theory, and I'll show you that this measure does not favor inflation. Okay, so this is a challenge. I'm giving you a measure, and I'm saying if you believe in inflation, you must show me a measure which is at least as credible as this measure, at least as simple and mathematically sound as the measure I will show you, and it's got to favor inflation. So the two ingredients I'm going to rely on, first of all, is really traces back to Penrose's critique of inflation, which has been, by and large, completely ignored, as far as I can tell. And the argument is very simple, that Hamiltonian evolution almost never turns a generic state into a highly unusual state. That's what inflation is supposed to do. It was supposed to take a generic early universe with randomly fluctuating geometry and turn it into a very unusual one, like the one we see, which is incredibly flat and homogeneous and has a horizon, apparently a horizon problem, and so on. So Penrose's argument says, well, GR plus any matter is a Hamiltonian system, and that just doesn't happen. Okay? Hamiltonian evolution doesn't do that. The canonical measure is invariant under time evolution. Okay, under canonical transformations, but time evolution is a canonical transformation. This measure is invariant. And so you could apply it at late times or early times and give you the same answer. So if you're trying to explain why the universe is unusual, okay, which is a problem at late times, why not just apply the measure there? And what's all this using, you know, the measure at early times? The answer shouldn't depend on where you apply it. So I will make use of this, but I think the reason people didn't take Penrose's arguments seriously is simply because he never really worked anything out. And so people doubted whether this measure is well-defined. And in fact, if you look at the measure, there are some issues with it, this canonical measure. The second ingredient I will use is the idea that when you count states in gravity, because that's what the measure should be doing, just counting states. When you count states, these, in many contexts, this can only be done in an asymptotic region where the global properties of the space-time become sharp. Okay, so we believe that if you have a fluctuating space-time, The only way to have sharply defined properties of the system is to consider an asymptotic region in which the global quantities specifying the space-time are defined. So an example is a black hole, and you define the ADM mass at large distances. In holography, the properties of the class of spacetimes you're considering are defined, the class is defined asymptotically at the boundaries of spacetime. So I'm going to use these two ingredients, And what I'll claim is that in a very specific setup, these two ingredients allow us to construct a completely canonical measure with no ad hoc ingredients. And according to this measure, a universe like ours is extremely unlikely in slow roll inflationary models. So let me just remind you, these are the basic equations of slow roll inflation. And they are, as you can see, Hamiltonian. Well, I haven't written the Hamiltonian yet, but they are Hamiltonian, and they're time reversal invariant. I'm going to be generous to inflation and just throw away all the inhomogeneities. So I just take FRW spacetimes, and furthermore, I'm going to assume V of phi is monotonic away from its minimum. No false vacua. Okay, so this is the setup for chaotic inflation. So our job is to focus, is to study these solutions and to see what a generic cosmology looks like. I'm going to make some other technical assumptions, which are made just to simplify and concretize the problem so that we get a completely precise treatment. I'll assume k is minus 1, so an open universe. And you can see from here that implies, firstly, that the scale factor is monotonic in time. It just increases. For example, from 0, it'll just run up to infinity. And the Hubble constant is monotonically decreasing. So in a sense, the scale factor and the Hubble constant are two natural times in a k equals minus 1 universe. I'll assume 0 lambda, final vacuum energy, and I'll compactify the spatial slices. So we take one of these hyperbolic compact universes, and that's just so that I have a finite volume and everything is completely well defined. None of the results I'll tell you depend on the size of that volume. So it's just like doing physics in a box and specify the box, do all your calculations, and ultimately take the box size larger than any scale you're actually interested in. So this is just a mathematical device, the compact hyperbolic universe. But in fact, it has been advocated as a very natural and maybe the most natural setup for chaotic inflation. Yeah. Yeah, it does. So what I mean here is, no. Co-moving box size. So I write an FRW metric with k equals minus 1, and then I just do some identifications on the spatial coordinates. Yeah. So I'm just doing this to keep everything finite. As I say, I wouldn't believe any answer if it depends on the box size. Well, with this setup, you can study all the solutions. Okay, I don't have to do slow roll anything. I can study the general solution to these equations. And it's a two-parameter family. You can think of this as fixing A. Think of A as the time. Fix A is the curvature radius, okay, because I took k to be minus 1, and so here's the curvature term. If k is minus 1, then A is the curvature radius of the universe. But it's a good time variable, so fix A, and then I can pick phi and phi dot. So there's a two-parameter family of solutions, and they all look like this. They have initial singularity, and a final region which is asymptotically flat. Okay, just because as A goes off to infinity, the matter decays away, and essentially you're left with Minkowski space. So that is the Penrose diagram for any one of these solutions. The dashed line here shows the boundary of my compactification volume. And because I compactify, even if, in fact, there is a one-parameter family in which the scalar field does not diverge on this surface, but even that case is singular because the compactification volume goes to zero. So they all begin with a singularity, and they end with essentially a box, an expanding box, which is locally Minkowski, and where the matter density goes to zero and gravity becomes unimportant. Yes, it does. Absolutely, yeah. And that may be a way out, okay? That may be a way out of this measure, and I'll come back to that later. So if you do not do this compactification, maybe the whole theory is completely changed. But you see, if people accept that, that's good, because then we can just throw out all of those chaotic inflation models which were justified on the basis of purely local arguments. Classically not. Well, quantum mechanically, if you study, okay, so the only, I don't know, okay, but quantum mechanically, the only way I know how to study this is with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And if you study the Wheeler-DeWitt equation with k equals minus 1, there's no barrier away from a equals 0. And in fact, the generic solution is kinetic dominated. And basically, the wave function oscillates infinitely many times before you get to a equals 0. So the semi-classical approximation seems to become better and better and better near a equals 0. So there's no indication of anything like a bounce or whatever, certainly for k equals minus 1. Maybe. But that goes beyond the classical. The question, sorry. Actually, somebody should be giving them microphones. that may be difficult. I think Ben's question was, isn't there a finite probability that instead of a singularity, I have a bounce? So maybe, but not classically and not according to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And that's all I know how to do. Okay, so let's try to define a measure. What do we want for a measure? Well, it should be positive, it should be normalizable, it should be independent of the coordinate slicing or the coordinates on field space. These are sort of obvious things which we want, so we just respect the symmetries of the theory. It should be independent of ad hoc external structures. It would be nice if it was independent of any cutoff, like a Planck scale cutoff, independent. I mean, this is, if these statements were true, then this would be a good measure, a reliable measure, independent of volume factors, co-moving observers, etc. Most important, this measure should surely just be the natural extension of the canonical quantum measure for the fluctuations to the background. We're given the theory. It has a canonical structure. We use that to compute the quantum fluctuations. Well, why don't we use it to compute the measure for the background? These two things come together. It doesn't really make sense to use the canonical measure for the quantum fluctuations and not do the same for the background. What is the canonical measure? Well, the canonical measure has been discussed for a long time, and it has a certain problem, which I'll claim, at least in the setup I'm talking about, has a simple resolution. The canonical measure is basically dpdq on phase space. So you write down, you calculate the canonical momenta for the scale factor and the field, and then there's a two-form, and this two-form is invariant under canonical transformations, including time evolution. And what you're supposed to do is calculate the integral of this two-form on some two-surface. At first sight, you have a four-dimensional phase space, because there's A, PA, phi, and P phi. But you also have the Hamiltonian constraint, and so it's really a three-dimensional space. And you should think of every cosmology as a curve in three dimensions, and then I need to draw some surface which the curves intersect and calculate this quantity, and that's the measure. This satisfies all of the conditions, 1 to 4, except normalizability. And the reason is because this surface, sigma, is not compact. See, in normal classical mechanics, the Hamiltonian is taken to be positive, or at least non-negative. And so if I fix a surface, Hamiltonian equals constant, a constant energy surface, that's necessarily compact. And so the analogous measure is finite. But in gravity, the Hamiltonian is zero, and the physical solutions are satisfy that through a balance between the positive and the negative terms. And basically, you can make the negative terms as negative as you like, the positive terms as positive as you like, and the result is that sigma isn't compact. And this happens in various ways. For example, if I pick sigma to be A equals constant, scale factor equals constant, then if you look at the Friedman equation, the Hubble constant can still be as big as you like, and the density in the scalar field can be as big as you like, even though A is finite. And so because the density in the scalar field can be as big as you like, this term can diverge. And the same is true if you pick H equals constant. It's a different surface, but it's still a similar argument shows that the integral is just infinite. So if we look at these solutions, here's a typical phase plot. And so this is for m squared phi squared inflation. And the inflationary solution is essentially this horizontal line. Phi dot is nearly constant. And phi is decreasing as you roll down the hill. And then spirals inwards towards the origin at the end of inflation. It's just the scalar field oscillating. A better picture is to go to three dimensions. And so, for example, you have the Hubble constant, which you can think of as the time, and then phi and phi dot, and then these trajectories kind of decrease in H and run down the plug hole. They all end up there. What we want to do is count all of these histories. Okay, that's the problem. That's the measure problem, is to assign a number to every class of trajectories. Well, how do we do this in flat space? In flat space, there's the canonical or Gibbs ensemble. You can't just integrate over the Liouville measure, dp dq. That doesn't make any sense. When I do statistical mechanics, I don't just integrate over phase space. I get infinity. It doesn't mean anything. And that's essentially what we're trying to do. So, you know, no surprise, doesn't mean anything in gravity either to just integrate over everything. What we do in flat space is we maximize the entropy subject to a constraint, which is that the energy is some fixed number. And we assume that the Hamiltonian is bounded below. And if we do this, this gives you the standard Boltzmann distribution. Now, it's interesting. So this concept of maximizing the entropy is actually much more general than equilibrium statistical mechanics. And I refer you to the papers of Jaynes, who discusses this very nicely. And he discussed the connection between information theory developed by Shannon, which identified this quantity, or the negative of it, as the information in some probability distribution. And he showed that if you minimize the information at fixed energy, you recover the canonical ensemble. But as he discusses in his paper, there's no reason why you shouldn't use this even in non-equilibrium situations, providing you're careful enough. So that's what I'm going to do, because we're definitely in a non-equilibrium situation. However, this won't work because Hamiltonian is zero on all physical states, so you certainly can't constrain its expectation value. Expectation value is just zero, and there's nothing you can do with it. So what else do we do? Well, in the models I've defined, k equals minus 1, 0 lambda, the matter density is diluted away at large A, gravity becomes negligible, and the expansion is just adiabatic. So at late times, you basically have a box slowly expanding, full of stuff, matter, but gravity is irrelevant. There's no gravitational back reaction to worry about, and gravity is completely irrelevant. Well, that's the place we know how to count states. And so we know exactly what to do in that situation. And then what I will argue is that that is what we should do. We should count states in the asymptotic region where gravity decouples and observables become sharp. And that's where we count the states. And so that now I have a well-defined measure. But I still have to get rid of this infinity. I said you shouldn't just integrate dp dq. Well, there's a very natural thing to do, which is to look at the entropy. If you have a physical system which is expanding slowly, there's an adiabatic invariant. And the adiabatic invariant is the entropy. So every trajectory of the system ends up on an adiabat curve. And it's very natural to label an ensemble of spacetimes by the particular adiabat, or label every spacetime by the particular adiabat it ended up on. So let me just show you a picture of this. Basically, if I have a box, if it was just matter, the energy would be a constant as a function of A, and I would fix the energy. If I have radiation, if the matter decayed into radiation, the energy would decrease, and I would label these curves by the final entropy. So that's my proposal. There is a well-defined measure. It's defined by the late-time final entropy of that set of spacetimes. Let's consider a generic cosmology, one of these solutions I showed you, and this is how it evolves. At late times, it's curvature-dominated. The 1 over a squared dominates. Earlier than that, there are oscillations of the scalar field. Before that, it was potential-dominated. This was the inflationary epoch. And before that, it was kinetic-dominated. This is what the generic solution, because kinetic energy goes like 1 over a to the sixth. And so this is what any one of these solutions looks like. And if I follow the system, what I'm interested in doing is following the system into this regime and then calculating the entropy. And that number will tell me which class to put the space-time in. So at late times, I can, for example, slice it in A equals constant. By the way, the whole construction guarantees you that the results are independent of whatever sigma slice I choose. The answers will not depend on that. But I can, for convenience, pick A equals constant. This is the two form. And every trajectory ends up down the plug hole going round and round the origin. And then the point is that every trajectory, for given A, it has an energy, which is the radius of this, or the size of this ellipse, and it has a phase, theta. The energy density goes like C over A cubed if I just have matter. And so rho A cubed is adiabatically conserved. That's this quantity C. And in fact, the asymptotic space-time looks like Minkowski space, albeit in these Milne coordinates, with 1 over A corrections. So this quantity C, which specifies the energy at given A, and also the entropy, the final entropy, it's proportional to C. That quantity C controls the deviations of the metric from flat spacetime. It's analogous to the ADM mass. So I would claim that if you're going to count states in the system, the natural place to do it is in the asymptotic region in which gravity decouples and C has a simple interpretation. You can solve the equations including back reaction. They look something like this. You see the scalar field oscillates. A is the time. There's this phase theta naught, a constant phase, and there's this constant C. In the large A limit, matter becomes, effect of gravity becomes negligible. We just have flat space-time, adiabatically expanding box filled with matter. If we, the statistical ensemble, we're in mini-superspace. Here's the Hamiltonian. We're just doing classical stat mech. Expectation value of the Hamiltonian for the matter, I said, equal to the energy, and calculate the entropy from P log P, and this is the entropy, and it's the log of the constant C. And this is an adiabatic invariant. So this is the calculation in the specific case where I just have the scalar field, no radiation, nothing else. But the concept is much more general. So as I've said, every trajectory we're going to specify through this number, the final entropy. And as is clear, when we do flat space statistical mechanics, I've got to specify some quantity to make the ensemble well-defined. And the quantity is just the energy at fixed A. Otherwise, you just have an ill-defined problem. Also want to point out, I've drawn this dashed line here. This dashed line shows the effect of the curvature term. It's going as 1 over A squared. So as I trace, so it's kind of effective contribution to the density goes as 1 over A squared. And if you trace it back, there is a danger that that curvature term will kill the inflation at early times. And that's what this curve shows. So if I fix, so it turns out the matter density, thanks, is C over A cubed. The curvature term is 1 over A squared. So they're equal when A equals C over here. This is, sorry, log C it should be. And so if I make C bigger, curvature is less important, and I won't destroy this early inflation. If I make C smaller, I will destroy the early inflation with curvature. I won't bore you with the technical details, but now everything is completely well-defined, and you can calculate the canonical measure for inflation, probability of n e-folds as a function of n. It goes like e to the minus 3n with a prefactor that depends on the particular potential. This is for phi squared. And this result is for C, or entropy, equal to infinity. Final entropy equal to infinity is this curve. If I make the C anything less than infinity, then I get even less inflation, just because it kills you at early times. And so you cut off the inflation at a number of e-folds of 1/3 log mc. Note, the attractor of inflation is actually a repeller, because we're defining quantities at late times. And so inflation works against you. And if you go back to that phase place plot, all the curves are diverging. And so what you did by focusing on the slow roll solution was just by hand ignore all of the other trajectories which joined you at later times and had much less inflation and, of course, had no long wavelength power either. So the kinetic domination would kill the scalar invariant power. So the statistical ensemble was defined in the asymptotic region where gravity became unimportant, which is the future. And that's why inflation works against you. If you have n fields, inflaton fields, inflations, just the problem gets worse because there are now n fields, which are in a repeller. And so the probability of n e-folds goes like e to the minus 3 n inflation, n fields. This makes precise the problem identified by Penrose long ago. And with this measure, slow-roll chaotic inflation cannot be considered a viable explanation for the observed state of the cosmos. I believe this can be extended to a landscape. Even if you have false vacuum, I don't think it really fundamentally changes things. Because what happens is there's some trajectories that will roll down and land in the false vacuum, and then they will tunnel through. And you can describe that tunneling with complex classical solutions, semi-classically. It's just a complex classical solution. And so I think this means you effectively have trajectories which have some probability for remaining in a part of phase space and some probability for tunneling through to another part. But I don't think, it certainly doesn't change the fact of the repeller. If your measure is defined in the asymptotic region where gravity is unimportant, inflation is a repeller. You could add some further restrictions. Don Page, for example, wants to restrict to only non-singular metrics, okay? And that will just throw out all of these solutions, okay? And since time is short, I won't go through in details arguments against these, but at least the framework that we have here gives you a very precise way to say, okay, this I'm throwing out, this I'm keeping, that's fine. What could be wrong? Could the canonical measure be wrong? I don't think so. I mean, this is fundamental to the theory. So I think you're really going to have a hard time arguing this is the wrong measure. Could it be entropy production? Could somehow the entropy production at the end of inflation save you? I won't go through the argument, but if somebody asks, I will. The relative proportions of phase space corresponding to different values of n inflation are preserved by reheating. Could it be the inhomogeneities which rescue inflation? That would be ironic. If inflation, you know, which is fundamentally a phenomenon of the zero mode, of the homogeneous mode, if that actually had to be rescued by inhomogeneities or quantum fluctuations, could this constraint on the final entropy be wrong? Maybe, but what alternative? I mean, in Perimeter, we've got lots of people working on quantum gravity, and they're very familiar with this problem. There is no energy in quantum gravity. How do you define an ensemble of spacetimes? And the only viable quantity is the entropy. And so I think it's unlikely that this constraint should be replaced by something else. The global structure. So Matt has already asked, maybe I shouldn't have done this compactification. I really need the whole of that infinite universe with bubbles and all that. And that's fine. If that's the solution, that's fine. But then we must stop talking about chaotic inflation in the traditional way, because then the global structure of the universe is important. Or maybe it's inflation. Maybe inflation isn't right. In fact, if you compare this just heuristically with the cyclic or ekpyrotic theory, which has lots of challenges I won't discuss, including getting through singularities, gravity in those theories is unimportant in the past. Those theories are asymptotically flat to the past. And now, and they're also an attractor going forward, but now the attractor's in the right direction. So that almost every trajectory undergoes almost all the ekpyrosis. And so it works in exactly the opposite way. I was going to say something about scale invariant perturbations, but I won't. Let me just summarize. Concordance cosmology has plenty of challenges. Singularity, tuning, reliance on anthropics. And the measure, I think there is a good measure. It just doesn't give the answer we wanted. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Neil, I agree with almost everything you say, surprisingly. I'd like to state the problem, which is really the Boltzmann problem.
Yes.
It goes back to Boltzmann.
Yes.
Boltzmann asked, I'm making this up, of course. I don't know exactly what he asked, but he asked, supposing you started out with a little tank of air in the corner of the room up there, and then you let the air out, and then the air comes and fills up the whole room. And before the room was all filled up, all kinds of interesting things happen, swirls happen, and so forth. At some time in the middle, if you were to stop it and say, run it backward, how many of the trajectories go back up into the air being in the corner of the room? And you would find out it was a negligible fraction
right.
of them.
Right.
So if you were to judge on the basis of what you see now,
right.
what the number of trajectories that goes back to what in fact happened to be the factual case that there was a bulb of air up in the room up there, you would come to the conclusion that the probability that the world, the room, the bulb of air started the way that it was known to start is negligible.
Right. Are you specifying that the air was in the corner at the beginning?
I'm telling you, yes, this is what happened.
Somebody opened a perfume bottle.
Empty. The room was empty, and some janitor came in and opened the valve.
No, but I think that completely confirms the point of view. It says you try to calculate the probability of this in equilibrium. It's almost zero. Therefore, something must have happened.
No, but in this particular case, going to the end of the story and running it backward is just the wrong thing to do. You go and you ask the janitor, what were the initial conditions?
We don't know the janitor.
We don't know the janitor.
So the question we're trying to address is, if I take a generic state of the system, does it look like the universe we see? Answer,
all right,
no.
First of all, to say to say that we haven't thought about this is untrue. I don't know how many of us have thought about it. I know I've written papers about it and was disgusted to find that Boltzmann had written them 200 years earlier. We have thought about it. But you're right. This is a challenge. And the only other thing I would say is I don't think we know that the global multiverse, in the way some of us like to think about it, is a Hamiltonian system.
Mm.
I don't think we know that it satisfies any rules that we're familiar with at this
point. That's an intriguing possibility.
Well,
absolutely.
If somebody can build a Hamiltonian theory of it, then we can start talking about it.
Absolutely.
At this point, I don't think that's true.
I totally agree. It will be very interesting to try to think
last
about.
Last thing is something that Raphael leaned over my shoulder. He said, I don't think this issue, this concept of measure here is the same as the concept of measure that some other people will talk about, which has to do with the measure of why we live with this cosmological constant rather than that.
Right.
Different issue, I think.
Right.
Okay.
But it must be the same issue of measure and projection.
It's a question of measure. It's a connected question, but it's a little bit different set of questions.
There is quite a different setup. I mean, people have this global picture and so on. So I've deliberately tried to make a toy model as simple as possible, and my target is really the conventional arguments for inflation, which you will find in every textbook. Yeah.
Just for those people who didn't understand my comment about the air in the room, you have a high mountain, a high point on the top of something. You roll the ball down from it.
Right.
If you ask what's the chances if you try to roll the ball back up that you get to sit on the top of the mountain, it's zero. That doesn't mean that somebody didn't roll a ball down from the top of the mountain.
Yeah. But the measure I'm using isn't intended as a theory. It's not supposed to be a theory. It's just counting generic states.
You're always going to find that if you run something backward, the probability that you get to the initial condition, whatever the initial condition is negligible.
I just want to point out an assumption in your talk, which I believe is going to be shared by every talk at this conference apart from two.
Okay.
Which is that different cosmological solutions of a given Lagrangian for gravity and some other fields are actually states in the same quantum mechanical system, which we have to count according to some standard measure. And there will be two talks that deny that point.
Very good. So what's your opinion? Is that a well-defined, summing over states in the, in, so, so
in,
here?
In our models, each cosmology corresponds to a different Hamiltonian quantum mechanics.
Ah. So that's very much in the spirit of what I was saying, except there is different energy in the final state. So if I think about my final box at late times,
if you wish,
this different states have different energy, and you can't, when you do a statistical ensemble, you cannot put them together. It doesn't make any sense. So in that sense, it's similar in spirit. There are, you've got to separate cosmologies into subclasses within which there's a sensible ensemble. I mean, indeed, that's the same spirit.
Except that I don't think you can separate cosmologies. That you, each cosmology has a set of quantum states, and you can count the quantum states in the standard way using entropic types of arguments.
So
you can't count different cosmologies.
You're saying there's an even worse problem, which is that the different cosmologies have different Hamiltonians.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Is this on? Yeah. So Lenny made this very important point that when we try to extrapolate entropy kinds of things backwards, we get it wrong. And we're used to that, and that's really true about the world around us. But I think it is an absolutely tough challenge for cosmology. So just the fact that we are used to it doesn't mean it's easy to understand in this sort of grand scale that we're trying to understand cosmology.
Okay, so I agree with Lenny that this is the Boltzmann problem, and I agree with Andy that it's a different problem in cosmology because there's no place to set initial conditions. The only place that I began to, I think there's more to say, when you try to sneak in at the end that the cyclic universe model might not be subject to this. As you said, we can evaluate the measure on the space of trajectories at any time, so including today.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned very briefly, we could include perturbations if we wanted to.
Right.
And so we can do that today.
Right. Right.
And it doesn't matter what the early universe cosmology is. It doesn't matter whether it was cyclic or inflationary or anything else. It remains true that the overwhelming majority of trajectories that look like our universe today did not look like our early universe at early times. And so this is just as much a problem for the cyclic cosmology as for anything else.
I agree with you in spirit, but there are important questions, which is essentially related to whether this is just Hamiltonian dynamics. So if I take a cyclic cosmology and I just ask what happened before the singularity, which is, I think, I understand, then what I said is true. I mean, but that's not evolving at all the way to today. So it's true in the sense that I have this past state that is simple. It's a scalar field oscillating in a vacuum. I run it forward. Almost every trajectory has almost all the ekparatic e-folding. So that part is true. What happens when I go through a bounce, okay, is presumably I lose some of the trajectories into black holes or some states that didn't make it to the future asymptotic state. And now we're getting into the question, maybe this isn't Hamiltonian. And in that case, there may be an escape. But you know, I agree with you, if everything is Hamiltonian, there seems to be no escape. But you know, in the cyclic case, you've got this clear opportunity at the bounce to lose some trajectories or have some violations of.
Yeah, I don't think we're disagreeing that much. It's a math fact.
Right.
That most trajectories that look like our universe at the present time don't look like our universe at early time.
Right.
And so you said maybe the canonical measure isn't right. The canonical measure is right as a mathematical measure, but the universe is telling us it's not the right way to count trajectories that actually happen.
Yeah, I mean, either there's a special initial condition, in which case, you know, that's the important thing.
This is a challenge. You're perfectly right. This is a challenge.
Okay. Great.
I think that even just within your toy model, that there's, or something very close to it, there is still an infinity hiding. Basically, if you have finite entropy in the future, as you evolve back, as I asked you earlier, I think that there will be a finite amplitude to bounce in a non-singular way because there's no conserved quantity that prevents it. And once you bounce in a non-singular way, then if the theory allows it, you'll get eternal inflation towards the past. Okay, you've set your future condition, so it can't happen up there, but it can happen to the past of a non-singular bounce.
Right.
And that will have finite probability there. And so there will still be an infinity that you haven't yet regulated.
The question is, how am I going to describe this bounce? It doesn't happen classically, doesn't happen according to Wheeler-DeWitt. Because Wheeler-DeWitt, you in this case, this very case, if you change variables to log A, what you find is the system has, there's almost no scattering. You just go off to, yeah.
Finite amplitude is difficult to argue with. So I'm just saying it's something that kind of self-consistently comes in and tells you that you still have some infinities here.
Okay. Yeah.
Raphael?
I apologize for not using you as a lightning rod. I think that, you really pointed out very profound problems. If anything, I would agree with some of the other people. I think one is underselling these problems by associating them with slow roll inflation. Because they are much more profound and they're much more general, and I can give you an example for each one of them. It's already been mentioned, the early universe entropy problem. You could accuse Big Bang nucleosynthesis of having that problem, right? It's a great theory, except that the entropy is earlier lower and afterwards higher, and we could say that's a bad theory because of that problem. There's clearly something we are totally missing about understanding how the universe started, and it probably, as Sean said, has to do with our prejudice that somehow it has to be a generic state. That doesn't seem to work. Another is you associated the cosmological constant problem with inflation. There was a large cosmological constant during inflation. At the end, miraculously, it all gets canceled out to the small value. But the same is true for electroweak symmetry breaking. Mm-hmm. You have 60 orders of magnitude higher cosmological constant before that happened, and then miraculously, it goes down to almost exactly zero.
Right.
That's just standard cosmology. That's stuff we think we understand.
I agree.
And then finally, what I would call the measure problem, which is the problem of the infinite number of occurrences of copies of what we see in a very large universe at late times. Again, we don't necessarily need to think of early universe cosmology to get into that trouble. We just need to use the data. The data tell us that there is a positive cosmological constant. There's no indication after 14 years or so of any changes, any slow roll going on that would bring this down to zero. This, by far the simplest interpretation is that we live in either a metastable or stable de Sitter vacuum, and that alone is enough to lead to this problem. Independently of what we say about slow roll inflation in the early universe, we're going to have an infinitely large universe where things happen over and over at late times. So I think these are all really important problems that we should study in their own right.
Okay. I just want to briefly mention the fact that in Penn State, Abai Ashtekar and Dennis Sloan have taken very, very seriously your canonical measure. So that they have applied your canonical measure to the Hamiltonian constraints of loop quantum cosmology. And what they have obtained is that slow roll inflation has a probability of 99.9%.
There you are.
And by the way, loop quantum cosmology provides also a very natural way to obtain non-singular universe with a bounce.
Yeah, that calculation cannot be correct.
Too bad.
They did some. I haven't quite identified where the problem is, but it simply cannot be correct.
Too bad.
I wish I could say more. But I absolutely do not understand. They have a classical system with a Hamiltonian and so on, and it falls.
They use your calculation. They use exactly the same technique that you have used.
Yeah, but here. I think they haven't interpreted it correctly. You see, the basic point is is totally obvious. Oops, sorry. I have to wave my hands. The point is that there is, you have the scalar field that ends up oscillating in its potential. And at each A, there's a particular phase of that oscillation. It's somewhere in the phase. So there's a constant phase. Now, the slow roll solution that has large numbers of E-folds has one phase, a very special phase. Okay, so if I tell you A, and you know there was lots of inflation, you can tell me that phase precisely, okay, with exponential accuracy in the number of E-folds. And that's true in their model. So the measure, this canonical Liouville measure, is just uniform phase. And according to that measure, you know, the probability of getting lots of slow roll inflation is exponentially small.
No, wait, they obtain also the fact that the number of e-folding is compatible with observation.
Yeah, so, but I just believe there must be a mistake.
Okay, let's thank Neil again. I'm going to have to cut the questions off here.